session number 27083, reel 60.
So, Henry, you found yourself at the back of the bridge.
I was at the back of the bridge, and there was a small group of Chinese sailors. And I could only suppose, it seemed to be rather like, in our ships, a flag deck. And it so turned out that these were signalmen. And so, all of course, necessarily through an interpreter. This very good army chap. And I turned to one and said, are you good at Morse? And he didn't get that. And I said, Morse code. And they didn't get that. And I said, flashing. And they got that. And I said, desperately scratching for something to say, how many words per minute, what speed can you read your flashing? And the answer came back, and I forget what the figure was, so many characters. And that brought me up with a round turn, because I'd asked the wrong question, of course.
Well, I was going to ask how, given the complexity of the Chinese language in its written form, how they did actually reduce this to a computerized form for computerized transmissions and for Morse. Did you ever discover that? Or
No, I didn't. I didn't actually discover anything that mattered at all.
During your whole period?
Yeah. The equipment was unimpressive. Very unimpressive. They had a few missiles scattered about, but nothing of any great consequence. This was the showpiece of their navy, and they had all too obviously, when externally things got a bit grubby, they slapped another coat of paint on. And the paint was, as about to say, inches thick. That's an exaggeration, but you could see layer upon layer upon layer. And yet, just ahead of the lead ship was the space research ship, with state-of-the-art aerials for space research. I was not invited to go on board her. I'd rather like to have done, but it wasn't on. Well, I think enough of that. It was a long day. It was a hot day. I was not impressed. And I was... in no way did my opinion of the fleet commander differ from the one I'd formed previously. And it wasn't... Well, I don't think I established any degree of rapport during that particular visit. And that brings me back, really, to the end. I went back to Peking. I was taken to a Chinese theater, and the lights fused, so they couldn't carry on, and it was very strange. The historic sites were very impressive. The wall, as I was taken to, the Great Wall, was not impressive, because they had foolishly, I think. They had reconstructed small sections of it, and they had done it crudely with modern building materials, and it stood out like the proverbial sore thumb, and was, curiously, absolutely creeping with Japanese tourists, all with six immense cameras strung round their necks in the usual Japanese way, and so on. And in due course, they saw me off from Peking again, I suppose, and back I went. And in retrospect, I wondered at the time if I had really achieved anything at all. And whereas it mattered not, name any country you like that I was privileged to visit. But all the others, you came away with a, how do I describe it, a warm feeling, a cozy feeling. You'd made some friends, you'd established real contact, you had achieved a real rapport with your opposite number and others, and to that extent it must be worthwhile. You could do business together by means of cryptography or remote signals and so forth, should occasion demand. Not so with China. I had not established a rapport. I had not felt that I'd really made any friends. I was unimpressed with practically everything I saw of today's vintage, except for the space reception, which I hadn't been allowed to see. And you could say the whole thing was a busted flush. But at least I reckoned that there would be very serious shortcomings in any struggle for the immediate future, because of sheer lack of training, the antiquity of the kit that they had both ashore and in their ships and so forth. It was a long haul. It was hard work, and you had to work at it the whole time. And really, as I say, it has achieved nothing. So I was glad to put a tick in that box and return to better things. I hate to say that, but I'm afraid it's true. Then the next visit was the other way around, and it was by an Indian defense minister who came to call on the chief of the defense staff. And he had the usual in Whitehall. And he had, I forget his name now, it doesn't matter. He had the usual sort of four-day program. And I offered to help out by having this chap and his team to lunch one day in my official flat. And my official flat, while I mention it, was to the side of Admiralty Arch on the north side. And it was known as the Mal House Flat. The other side of the arch, of course, was the old Admiralty, which was then occupied entirely by civil servants. Because the Admiralty, as had been, it was entirely absorbed in the Ministry of Defence. And the Mal House had been the residence of the first Sea Lord of the day. And over the years it had changed hands a bit. But it had a very grand marble staircase, and so on. The only bit left to the first Sea Lord was the top story, which was known as the Mal House Flat, because it was no longer used as the Mal House, and the rest of the rooms split up had become offices and so on. And it was very convenient, of course. You could get down to the MOD in a matter of 3 minutes by car. I'd originally set my sights at always walking round St. James's Park on my way to the office in the morning. I did that twice in my 3 years. And the rest of the time, the pressure was such that you couldn't spare that time.
Was this a 7-day-a-week job? It sounds like as if it was.
No. Well, yes and no. Normally, no. But there were occasions when the volume of stuff, and you always took boxes away, and you might have to work quite long hours over a weekend. But normally, no. in all my previous jobs, I'd found that being a keen gardener, the part I was gardening, you could completely switch off and concentrate on pruning that rose or pulling that weed or whatever. But during my time as first, I found that you couldn't, because things had got to such a pass in terms of the Defence Review, or later the Falklands War, that you could not detach your mind. And so you were doing things in the garden with your hands, but your mind was on the job. How did I get on to the Mall Flat? Oh yes, because I'd asked this Indian minister to lunch. And that was gladly accepted by Admiral Lewin, the Chief of Defence Staff. And on the day, along they came. And I had... he was behaving very strictly, so I rather suppose that he would have a soft drink before lunch, which indeed he did, and nothing to drink with lunch. And I had selected the menu with some care, knowing that, trying to play it on totally safe ground. And I forget what we had, but we had... I think we had an egg dish as the main course. We probably had soup or something to begin with. And I can't remember what the entree was, but just glancing across, I had the minister sitting opposite me. And he'd been accompanied by his second sea lord, who I had known slightly before, a nice man who sat next to me. And when he didn't touch his starter, I thought, oh well, you know, this chap's going to be difficult, and I didn't think any more. And eventually the places were cleared, and we then had a sort of egg dish, and the eggs were shown, or the dish was shown, handed to the minister first, and the he said, what is this? And I told him what it was. And he said, I cannot eat this. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. Wondering what the hell we had out in the kitchen as an alternative. Is there any alternatives that you would fancy? And he said, perhaps a piece of cheese. Well, okay. So I instructed my chief steward to produce... I summoned him. By this time, everybody else had been helped and were underway, to produce a piece of cheese. And I hoped that this would be some delicate little thing that would really be quite attractive, because he had just time to tart it up a bit. And in came... splendid petty officer steward with an enormous lump of mousetrap on a plate, and he plonked it down in front of the minister. It was very heavy going indeed.
What were the reasons for his...
He turned out to be a vegetarian. Oh. It was as simple as that. And if only one of his team could have said, Bloggs is a vegetarian, we'd have played it accordingly. I didn't mind having vegetarian food. But he didn't play it that way. Well, I'm switching again. When I took over, the Defence Secretary was Francis Pym. Still alive, I think. So I now switched to being... careful in any strictures I may otherwise wish to apply. He was a most charming man, had a very charming wife. He was perhaps not the most decisive of ministers, and indeed he made it pretty clear in short order that he didn't awfully like having to make up his mind on things that that really mattered, were potentially important. And of course the defense review was really on, but a great deal of discussion was attending it at the time.
Can I ask, when did the defense review start? Presumably the government initiated it, or did they inherit it?
No, it was when they took over. This is an entirely conservative firm. Entirely.
And without wishing to jump the gun at all, at what point did you start to realise what this defence review meant and contained? During Pym's secretary?
No, very much during Pym's time. Yeah, yes, very much so.
Can you, I'm sure you will, but will you be able to talk me through that?
Because this parts of it, yes.
Because what I'm trying to identify is at what stage did you realise that this was not going to be a 10% off here and 5% off there, and we'll mothball a couple of frigates and that'll be the end of the day?
Quite early on, because the size of the cuts being mooted was such that you didn't make enough savings by such means. I mean, you went through all that, obviously, as starters, but you were then left with an enormous bulk deficit. Anyway, Pym he was briefed from time to time on this. As I say, he wasn't, he didn't terribly enjoy, I think, taking important decisions. And Frank Cooper, the permanent secretary, very able, he resurrected a thing which had fallen into abeyance called the Defence Council. And the Defence Council, which had been set up, I suppose, in Mountbatten's day, and it really involved everybody borrowing the kitchen sink, so to speak. There must have been. It had all the chiefs of staff, of course. It had the intelligence lot. It had some seniors, quite a number of senior civil servants. You name it. They were members of the Defence Council. There was a so-called Defence Council suite, which was a set of rooms in one particular spine of the MOD, never used for anything else except farewell parties. And Frank Cooper resuscitated this in order to get the Defence Secretary to be seen to be deciding things. And clever chap that he was, Frank Cooper concocted the agenda, and I say concocted because he did so very skillfully, so that in real terms it didn't make a lot of odds whether the answer was yes or no, and so there could be discussion and a decision would be taken to go for one or the other. And it frankly couldn't have mattered less what the decision was. And so it was. And we had this thing from time to time. It was a fatuous waste of time. But meantime, the defense review, the cuts exercise, was rolling along. And give him his due, Francis Pym, after a certain stage, became convinced that to apply such horrendous cuts, possibly particularly to the Navy, but to some extent all round, made no sense. And it really was beyond the realms of good husbandry for the sake of the country as a whole. And he wasn't, he was a delightful personality, but he wasn't a terribly strong one. He wouldn't mind my saying so, I think. He was just a very decent chap. And he managed to hold his own in cabinet. And of course, for every bit that he, as a defense minister, the defense secretary, contested that this was absurd, and so you couldn't get that from defense, meant that some other department or departments had to cough up instead. And so in cabinet, every other man and woman's hand was against him. And in spite of that, he held his own in cabinet. And he wouldn't give in. He was, there were those who described him as brute obstinate, but he stuck to his guns, and he just either said nothing or said no. And he got away with that for a year or so. And this eventually got under the skin of the Prime Minister, of Margaret Thatcher, who, at whose door, really, I think it is fair to say, the fault, if you care to use that term, of the Defence Review really lay. And the Defence Secretary was merely the implementer of what she had said. She must have so much out of defence. And she frankly didn't give a rap what gave in defence to produce that figure, provided it was produced.
Right, now this goes to the bottom of what I was trying in my mind to get clear. We all remember that the first years of Mrs. Thatcher's first administration, if not the whole of the first her first administration, were dominated by things known as the cuts.
Yeah.
And would it be correct to say then that what the government had done was that they'd said, we need to cut X percent from the total government spending across the board, from what we inherited from the previous Labour administration. Defence is going to have to come up with Y percent of that X percent, and we'll worry about what our defence commitments are afterwards. In other words, after the review. In other words, it's an entirely money-driven defence review, and then we'll see what our commitments, what we can manage to operate subsequently. Would it be that way around, or did they, was there any hint, did you get any hint, any idea that they had said, well, let's reduce our commitments to this level and see if this reduced level of commitments meets the degree of financial cuts that we wish to make?
No, it was the former. The question of reduction in commitments didn't really feature at all. It was entirely driven by the economics of the situation. So much had to be saved overall. Defence's slice was so-and-so. And that's what I will have, thought the Prime Minister. Up to you how you produce it. But it's out of defence.
And fine. And then later in your analysis of the Defence Review and how it went with Francis Pym and John Knott, you will tell me, I'm sure, how it was that the Navy ended up bearing the brunt.
Yes.
Because there are obviously three services.
I will.
Thank you.
Well, there it was. And so, very much to Pym's credit, he stood his ground in cabinet.
Yeah.
And this irritated the Prime Minister enormously. And it made life very difficult, I think, for Pym. He took to holding little dinner parties at his club. And these would start at 7:30, and you would have a couple of drinks, and then you'd move into the dining room. The chiefs of staff were present, the intelligent people were present, Frank Cooper was present, as he virtually always was when the chiefs of staff met, and so on. And I think Francis Pym found these meetings, I'm not sure whose idea they were originally, I think they were his. I think he felt that in the more relaxed circumstances of the informality of a private dinner like that. And security was covered because we had a room to ourselves and so forth, and we had service waiters and so on. That this would free everybody from their constraints. Discussion would be more direct, and decisions could be taken. It wasn't, frankly, how it worked out. And I think, being the man he was, he found all this Cutts business seriously, deeply, against his instincts and against the grain, and hence these meetings, because this was more about the allocation within the overall spectrum of the Cutts themselves, rather than the size of the Cutts and so on. It was the distribution of them more. And so, shall I merely say that he stiffened himself for the ordeal ahead with a couple of G&Ts before we arrived. And by the time we sat down, he was in a fairly congenial mood. And I can only say that one way or another, did a little business, serious business, actually got done.
Henry, there's a thesis to be written here by someone, an earnest individual in a Midwestern university, on the influence of alcohol on big decisions. Because sometimes the influence is for big decisions that are taken, that are wholly wrong and taken, and here perhaps the congeniality of the circumstances result in very little being done.
It was the latter. Well, the net result was that Francis Pym was shifted sideways to Leader of the House, and John Knott, who had been in trade, was put in, and he was put in, as quickly became apparent, he was put in as the hatchet man. Get such and such out of defence. And we're talking of substantial sums. On the way, as soon as he'd taken over, he was subjected, of course, to the usual briefings of any new defence secretary or minister. He was briefed individually by the chiefs. He was briefed collectively by the chiefs. And Terry Lewin, Chief of Defence Staff, who by then had left because he had to, the Mall flat, and I'd moved into it. And he had moved down and taken over what had once been the Admiral President's house at Greenwich.
This is Terry Lewin.
This is Terry Lewin,
CDS,
Chief of Defence Staff. Yes. He'd moved down there.
Not his office. That's merely That's not his office. That's merely his.
That's merely where he rested his weary head, and where he did his entertaining. And he, in order to try and, in a more detached, like going away for a thinking that. Top cats are inclined to do from time to time when they go to some country estate and spend a delightful weekend and they resolve their business or do they. Anyway, he collected the chiefs and John Knott, and it was for his Knott's benefit at Greenwich, and we met one afternoon and he spent about 5 minutes with each individual chief of staff in the presence of the others. And he started with, I think he started with Terry Lewin, and I think he went on to Frank Cooper. And then he turned to me and he very quietly said, Why do we need surface ships? That came very close to saying, why do we need a navy? And so I started to explain. And then Terry Lewin intervened and said, I think you only have 5 minutes, Secretary of State, and I think really that that is too big a question to be answered in that time. And I can't remember what else he asked me. I don't think he did much. He moved on to the next step, I think, and so on. Very early on in his time, quite rightly, rather as I had myself been doing, he went over to Washington, and on the way back, to meet his opposite number, and on the way back, he stopped off and spent, I think, a night or a day. It was a day, actually, I think, and it was a wet Sunday, I seem to remember, in Bermuda. This was convenient to his flight plan, and he thought he'd, to an extent, killed two birds with one stone, I think. And during that wet Sunday afternoon in Bermuda, pretty well on the back of an envelope, he sketched out what he thought should be the broadest...
Excuse me.